KBOO Community Radio is a proud co-sponsor of Mercy Killers, a play presented by Healthcare for All Oregon on Thursday, September 17th at the Alberta Rose Theater. Mercy Killers addresses the measures the main character must take to care for his sick wife. The play is being performed as a benefit for Healthcare for All Oregon, who work for an affordable, comprehensive, publicly funded, high-quality, universal healthcare system serving everyone in Oregon. Again, that's Mercy Killers, Thursday, September 17th at the Alberta Rose Theater, 3000 Northeast Alberta Street in Portland. More information can be found at kboo.fm on the right side of the homepage under Community Events. Oh, mercy, mercy.
Well, good morning. This is Per Fograng, and the show is Fight the Empire. And I'm very pleased that my guest today is Emmanuel Saccarelli, who is a co-author, along with Latha Varadarajan, of a very interesting book called Imperialism, Past and Present. So, Emmanuel Saccarelli, welcome to KBOO.
Thank you very much, Per.
Yeah, well, why don't we jump right in, because this is our membership drive, so we have to kind of cut our half hour, 5 minutes short to do a little message to our listeners and sponsors. And so that'll be at the end of the show. So in your book, you talk about imperialism. It's not empire and it's not colonialism. It's a system. So why don't we start with that? What kind of system is imperialism?
Very well. Thank you. Yes, we in our book, there are, let's say that there are certain longstanding confusions over this term imperialism. So part of the aim of the book is to try to clarify those confusions. Empire, I think, is a concept that has a broader applicability. There were empires for millennia. You know, the Romans had their empire. I think imperialism is a distinctly modern phenomenon. That's what we try to argue, and it's and it arises out of certain economic developments. Certainly, the transformation of capitalism toward a kind of monopolistic direction, among other things. So we try to show that this system. It's certainly an international system. It certainly involves predatory types of actions on the part of the imperialist powers. But it's not the same as any other empire of the past. It had certain specific characteristics which are bound up with a modern economy and a host of other transformations which we discuss in the book.
Now, in your book, you say that there is a, there's a big kind of a financial aspect to this. We talk about financial capitalism. So that is one of the hallmarks of this kind of up-to-date modern imperialism. So tell us about that.
Yes. We call attention to that. It's that part of the argument is certainly not original. This has been highlighted in the early 20th century, certainly by certain figures, which we find very influential and correct on this point. And the point is that capitalism in its original form, was not dominated by finance capital. Finance was a sort of a handmaiden to industrial capital, for example, the railroads. In the United States, we talk about that in the book. But eventually, and certainly by the early 20th century, finance comes to really dominate the capitalist economy in this country, as well as in other advanced capitalist countries. And eventually also that domination comes to take a very sinister and parasitic form. That is, finance originally sort of aids the production of things, but past a certain point, it begins to really hinder it. To the point that today, and we spent some time on this, I think it would be fair to say that the hedge fund managers and these types of figures, their activities are not particularly connected to the production of socially useful things. In fact, you might say that they disrupt that process. And so finance comes to dominate capitalism in general, and that comes at certain political and economic costs. And that is also connected to these predatory forms of foreign policy, which we say, and other scholars have said in the past, are really the answer to some of the baffling behavior on the part of in the international arena on the part of imperialist states.
Well, when the when people talk about the capitalism, the United States used to export. It was a sort of the big factory of the world right after World War II, and it made all sorts of stuff, exported it everywhere in the world. But now we are exporting capital. And sort of what does that mean? Is that like predatory lending or what?
There's definitely plenty of that, and this is not even just a question of sort of nation to nation. I think there is the problem of predatory lending for sure, but more broadly, there's the question of let's say irrational and humane use of global resources, which I think it's fair to say finance capital is that's not its business. There are those sorts of questions bound up with that. And certainly, we think that the kind of economic relations that exist today and have existed, for a century and a quarter, more or less, that is imperialism, is not some kind of win-win situation. Even after the collapse of colonialism and colonial empires, new forms of exploitation were developed and partly bound up with export of capital in certain ways, exploitation of labor in certain ways. So yes, that's definitely part of the overall picture.
Well, what does this do to the economy at home? I mean, it's like I don't know. Here we have a country that produces less than it used to. Jobs have been shipped overseas. All the big money makers are, they're on Wall Street, just kind of, playing these financial games and making billions of dollars doing this. But what is it? Where does that leave the rest of us?
Right, and this is. I think I'm glad you asked that because it's an important part of our argument. We don't. Sometimes the language of imperialism is bound up with condemning entire nations, let's say, which have been guilty of historical crimes. But I think it's important to point out that the American working class has been really a victim of this system as much as, or at least to a significant degree, if not as much as other working populations around the world. The United States has seen a real decay in its economic position in the world. As you rightly pointed out, it used to be the workshop of the world. It no longer is. And who has paid for that? It's been the American, what used to be called the American middle class. I'm not sure that entity can still be said to exist today. So certainly the ordinary people are in this country, I think, are also affected by this very negatively, even though, of course, there are also ways in which they're told they're not. But the levels of inequality in this country are absolutely staggering. Yes, enormous amount of wealth is generated by various means, increasingly more and more financial transactions of a speculative character, but there's no trickle down. And so so I think that needs to be said.
Well, why don't we look at imperialism in action? Now, in your book, you really kind of start out with the Berlin Conference of 1885, which was very important. Tell us what did they do there?
Yes, well, this was an attempt to carve out Africa in particular on the part of various imperialist powers. Some of them were old. Some of them were very new, including the United States. And they, in a very gentlemanly fashion, sat down at a table and essentially created the map of modern Africa today. This is an important moment because, well, among other things, it really created the political divisions that exist on the continent to this day, for the most part. But also it showed an early moment in which imperialist powers could collaborate more or less peacefully amongst each other, even though what they were doing was in fact planning out an enormous historical crime. What happened to Africa, the situation in Africa today is very much connected to that early moment. What's interesting about that moment is that it doesn't last, because more and more that division of the world that was carried out at Berlin, with the changing in the relation of forces amongst different imperialist powers, that more and more forceful calls for a redivision of the world were made. And so what could be settled in a relatively amicable manner in the late part of the 19th century eventually leads to World War One and to a 20th century of immense carnage. And that's a kind of a systematic feature of imperialism as we see it, that you might have moments of peace and even very meaningful forms of cooperation and agreement, but it is not possible in the long term for that to last, and we mean that to this day. So when we have United Nations and all sorts of organizations that are devoted to international cooperation, but the fundamental reality of imperialism makes these attempts ultimately unsustainable.
Well, this is kind of a little sidelight, but we read a lot in the news about these nations, especially in Africa, where you have within the borders of one nation, you have two or more antagonistic tribes or nationalities or whatever, and civil wars going on. And this is due to the fact that the Europeans drew up these borders in the first place. Like Nigeria is a good example. You have Muslims in the north, Christians and animists in the south, and you actually did have a civil war, the Biafra War, back about 30, 40 years ago. And, we think, oh, well, look at those Africans. They can't get along. Well, it was the Brits that created that border in the first place.
Yes, I think you're absolutely right. I think that besides those religious divisions in Nigeria, I think the number is something along the lines of 250 or so distinct ethnic groups, all sort of stuffed into a container called Nigeria, which in a certain sense really makes no sense, and it's the irrational product of policies that were really carried out for a very, let's say, not particularly noble reasons. But it's also a great illustration of how the legacy of imperialism is very much present today, that it really shaped and continues to shape the world we're in. And so long as we don't put that in the focus, it becomes easy to sort of blame people who are, in fact, in a general sense, victims of these processes.
So then these nations, the European nations, after carving up Africa to kind of suit their own interests, about 30 years later, these empires were at war. I remember looking at all the nations in Europe, you got about 11 or 12 empires there, and the big ones were You know, you had the English and the French on one side, you had and the Russians on one side, then you had the Germans and the Austro-Hungarians and the Ottomans on the other side, and this is a horrible war.
Yes, it's an absolute carnage. We think it was the first product on a world scale of imperialism. I think, and even this is a historical question that has immediate contemporary purchase, because it's not an accident that last year we write about this in our book. Many of the powers that participated in World War One began to launch these official celebrations of World War One and sort of whitewash that history and present it as a somehow a good war, not something that was carried out on the basis of the motives we just talked about.
Oh, well, the Brits plant their poppies everywhere. That happened. Was that last year they did that?
Yeah. I mean, the way we follow this, I mean, basically every country, Australia somehow was particularly determined to really celebrate its participation in that absolute carnage that was World War One. Then, of course, there are other issues bound up with this, because World War One is difficult to sanitize, even though they're trying. But we also write about World War Two, which has a very different type of reputation that has settled around it. But we also think that was an imperialist conflict, just as much as World War One, even though that argument is a little bit more challenging. I think it needs to be explained very carefully. But imperialism did not end in 1914, and virtually all of the unfinished business of the First World War was carried over quite directly to the Second.
Well, you make one interesting observation. The First World War, you know, one of the things that really kind of brought it to the end was the Russian Revolution, because one of the big allies fighting Germany dropped out because of mass protests. People just were totally fed up with this war. And so what happened was, as this took a huge portion of the globe away from, the imperialists had sort of divided everything up. They sort of owned the world. And then all of a sudden, a huge portion of it kind of slips out of their grasp.
Yeah, that's a great point, Per. We spent some time on that. And it's, of course, a very politically controversial issue. But I think it's a matter of historical record that the Russian Revolution really brought this horrible conflict to a close at great cost, incidentally, to the Russian masses themselves. It was a real blow, not just against the Tsar, but against the international system of imperialism. One of the first things that they did, the new Soviet government, was to expose all the sordid machinations carried out by the various imperialist powers. They published the secret treaties that had been entered into by rival powers behind the backs of their own population. They very immediately made a call to the colonized people to pledge their active solidarity. This really was in many ways a game changer, as they say today, even though ultimately, of course, it didn't solve the problem. But I think it did go some ways in showing at a minimum that to break with imperialism as a system requires not a set of well-meaning reforms, maybe not even one revolution, because they had to make a couple there. And I think that point today carries over very well. In Egypt, for example, the Egyptian people attempted to break with that system in 2011, and so far it hasn't worked out. But I think the Russian revolution is really a crucial event that needs to be studied very carefully in understanding the possibility to break out of imperialism as an international system.
Well, the you know, the imperialists sort of got in on that act too, because didn't Germany send Lenin to back to Russia in a sealed railway car or something?
Well, that's an old tale. I think there are a number of let's leave it at it's a long story. But the way in which the imperialists got in on the act in Russia after the revolution was to send many armies to crush the new Soviet government. There were, I think, something in the order of 14 to 17 major and minor capitalist powers which sent troops, including the United States. And I think that's because they really understood what they were confronting in the new Soviet government, and they really attempted to put it down very, very quickly.
Well, I think some of them thought they could cash in on it, but it didn't turn out that way.
No, it didn't. Although, of course, you know, already by the mid-20s, the Soviet Union had taken a somewhat different turn, and its own commitment to a struggle against imperialism certainly waned somewhat for a series of reasons that I think are a bit on the complex side. But it was definitely a flash of great inspiration for many people in the colonial world. There were all sorts of intellectuals, peasants, workers who were very impressed with what the Soviet Union represented. Unfortunately, later on, it became a little less impressive, let's say.
Well, it's interesting now is that in some ways, you know, while World War One, like you said, has led to World War Two, when that ended, the U.S. was the kind of the dominant power. And then when the Soviet Union collapsed, we had people in Washington thinking like, you know, nobody can stop us. But since then, everything has really kind of gone all to hell.
I agree with you. I think that's a great point. And I think to draw out the contrast between the initial promises after 1991 and the reality over the course of the past 25 years should really strike people and make them reflect on what was the real issue in the 20th century. Because in 1991, with the fall of the Soviet Union, a set of promises were made, series of slogans, New World Order, which at the time didn't quite have a Orwellian ring to it when Bush the first spelled it out. They talked about dividends of peace. They talked about a new economy that was going to benefit everyone. And this was all understood to be possible because the big bad Soviet Union was at last vanquished. And so we could all look forward to a period of great peace and stability. And the past 25 years have not been that whatsoever.
Well, now we're blaming Putin for everything.
Yes. Right, and there's that as well. I think this is an important historical test, let's say, for capitalism, because much of its problems were in one way or another blamed on the existence of this horrible regime behind the Iron Curtain. We are supporting various dictators and coups in Latin America. Why? Because we have to fight communism. And in 1991, if you like, that excuse went away. And so you had a real opportunity for capitalism, and I would say American capitalism in particular, to prove that it could deliver prosperity and stability for all. I think what he has done is quite the opposite.
Well, is there anything that can bring down, that can end this imperialism? One thing that occurs to me is that since it's based on financial capitalism, and you have, you know, debts have exploded, and if these debts don't get paid, what happens then? Would that end the system, or what would it do?
Yes, I think for that, I think the case of Greece is very important. It's another kind of tragic laboratory for that kind of prospect. Certainly, we know that financial capital, in particular, is exerting immense pressure on Greek society to the point of really strangling it. I would say. I mean, they're really in the process of dismantling a once functional society. You know, they cannot put any money into hospitals, basic necessities, schools, and all of that in order to satisfy the payment of these loans. And I think there, since your question was what can be done, I think the case of Syriza is particularly revealing, and I'm going to say this in relation to the Russian Revolution very, very directly, because here you have a movement that was developed on the basis of a criticism and rejection of austerity politics, austerity policy, I'm sorry. And what happened there is that this movement carried out, really, I would say, a staggering betrayal of the Greek population by ultimately calling a referendum. The referendum reiterated the opposition of the Greek population to all these policies, and yet Syriza capitulated. So, in a sense, what that tells me is that the way out and the way forward cannot necessarily pass through very easy a path of compromise and reform may not be the path.
Okay, well, we've been talking with Emmanuel Saccarelli, who is a co-author of this book, Imperialism, Past and Present. And this book is yours. It's a very short, readable book. It's yours for, a $60 pledge.
I'd like
to thank you, Professor Saccarelli. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you, and thanks to your listeners. Thank you.
And now, listeners, let's talk to you. We need you to, keep this station going, because it gives you news and information. It talks about books that are really worth reading that you don't find anywhere else on the radio dial. So, who we got out there? Lynn, I see Lynn out there.
Yeah. Hey, this was a fascinating show. You were talking about imperialism with perhaps a critical eye. You know, I always say, what is it good for? Imperialism, what is it good for? Oh, lining the coffers of the war profiteers. Yeah, that's about it. But this was a great intellectual discussion about that with historians, people that knew about history. You know, I was just listening to BBC go crazy about the Jeremy Corbyn election in Britain. Oh my God, that someone left could actually be there, and dissecting it and trying to see how things couldn't happen, whereas Pear was just talking to Emmanuel Saccarelli about how we could possibly end imperialism. That is a unique thing to KBOO News and Public Affairs. So try to donate now, 877-500-5266 for $60. Minimum donation. You can do more than 60. We really don't care. That's good for us. You can get this book, Emmanuel Saccarelli's Imperialism, Past and Present. It sounds like a really fascinating book. And support KBOO, support Pear. Ken?
Yes, in fact, we broke that down. $60 where you can get the book. It's not just $5 a month. It's $1.15 a week, 16 cents a day. So, and you could do it as a sustaining member too. So that means you give us a monthly amount. You could take that out of a credit card, a debit card, electronic funds transfer through a checking account. Give our volunteers a call at 877-500-5266, and they could work it with you at whatever's most convenient, what's most comfortable. You know, Lynn, as I was coming in this morning, one of the big news stories also is the Sequoias.
Right. In fact,
Moreland.
We have KBOO's own SW concert out there now, sussing that out, because that's what we do at KBOO. It's local. We do not just do international news. We do local news. And so we've got $500 to raise in just a few minutes for Pear, and I know he has loyal listeners out there for himself, but also just for the station. 877-500-5266. Sorry, I interrupted you, Ken. What were you?
Oh, no. I was going to say that we've been in touch. KBOO's been covering the story. We've been in touch with some of the activists there. And I actually got an email this morning from one of them that said that really the only coverage of that event has been through KBOO and then one TV channel, Coin TV. Other than that, really nobody's connected the dots. It's one developer, Vic Remmers of Everett Custon Homes. We've been covering the story, been trying to get in touch with Vic Remmers, but have been unsuccessful, not surprisingly, I guess. And if that's really the power, I think, of independent media. In other words, a lot of local media outlets are ignoring this story, which I think is of great importance to a lot of people in Portland. These are 100-year-old trees, older than 100 years, ancient old-growth trees, sequoias, beautiful trees if you go there in East Moreland and take a look. And this morning, there's a lot of police there, conscious down
off.
There.
Yeah, they just went out there. So, but to support this sort of thing, this
exactly.
sort of truly grassroots, tree roots. we could even say.
Yes,
Tree Roots reporting 877-500-5266 for the news you're not supposed to know, which is not just Teresa Mitchell's show. It is all the news and public affairs on KBOO. This morning we had Pear was talking about imperialism, past and present. It's a fascinating discussion because these are things that are happening now with Emmanuel Saccarelli. You can get this book for a $60 minimum donation by dialing 877-500-5266. If you're in your cubicle at work and you can't call out, you can go to kboo.fm and you can go on our website. It will easily take you to where you need to go to give us money, because this is what we do two or three times a year. We have no commercials, but two or three times a year, we have to have money to keep the lights on, to keep the transmitter working, to pay our staff, very, very important things.
Oh, to keep public affairs programming like you're listening to this morning and every weekday morning, and news, Democracy Now! At 7 and 4 p.m. every weekday,
right.
Our p.m. news at 5 p.m. In fact, I have a stat here, Lynn. We were talking about independent media, and that's becoming kind of the dodo bird of media.
The polar bear, if you will. We could go on and on with that.
Yes, there's a lot of animals in danger of extinction. But independent media is actually one of them. Five companies now own the majority of the media in the Portland area. Five companies determine what you hear, except for the independent outlets like KBOO, and we need your support if you want to keep us independent. You can see how important it is to cover stories that you're not going to hear elsewhere, or to cover